The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
For Master Dogen's teaching of the Ten Directions, Shakyamuni Buddha said to the assembly, "In the Buddha land of the Ten Directions, there is only the Dharma of the One Vehicle." And from the Lotus Sutra, "The Ten Directions spoken of here have taken up the Buddha land and made it what it is. Thus, without taking it up, there can be no Buddha land, because it is the Buddha land. The Buddha is its host." That's Dogen. So, good afternoon, Bodhisattvas. I was thinking of Sesshin as Buddhism is often spoken of as mind training, ceasing from harm, practicing good, studying and realizing the mind. We speak often of Zen training, Dharma training. And when we think of Sesshin that way, it helps to give rise to the sense of there's something that we're actually engaged in, which is very deliberate. It's very intentional. It is a particular way of engaging the Dharma. We call it training. And it sort of ties in with the sense we have of training in all kinds of disciplines, medical or academic, musical, artistic, athletic, where we engage something. We develop skills, we cultivate those over and over. They become more natural, more effortless, more integrated. We study with a teacher, someone who has gone before us. And it helps to elevate it in our mind as something that has those qualities, and we're engaging it. It helps to keep an active edge to it. That can also, at the same time, set up a sense that it is somehow apart from ordinary life, is somehow special in a way that may not be helpful. And so if we also think of Sesshin as just living, because it is. If you do a year of residency, you will do 3 months of Sesshin, right? That's a quarter of your year's Sesshin. So that's, you could look at that as a lot of Sesshin training, or you could look at that as 3 months of your year of living in a particular way. And those of you at home, I'd find it much easier to think of it as living as you, practicing Sesshin as you are within your home and circumstances. And that helps to ground it and sort of normalize it. So on the one hand, it is something special. It is something extraordinary. We shouldn't waste it. As I spoke about on Monday night, I really believe that it's one of the sort of a family of aspects that have been particularly important in our own Sangha and in our own development over the years. And at the same time, there's something very ordinary about it. We do many of the same things that we do every day as practitioners, but we shift the balance a little bit. And that can help to ground it and make it not so much, you know, from Monday to Sunday, but just, oh, during this week, I am living in this way, practicing in this way. In the Buddha land of the 10 directions, there's only the Dharma of the one vehicle. So since the time of the Buddha, it's recognized that there are different ways people will practice the Buddha Dharma and will just take up a spiritual path. And so the Buddha recognized Pratyeka Buddhas, who are solitary Buddhas, who practice alone, who don't study with a teacher, and they come to enlightenment on their own. And so that's recognized, that they've awakened, that they have, in a sense, trained themselves. And also that typically, or within the sort of context of Buddhism, that the Pratyeka Buddha has no further aspiration. They don't want to do anything more than that. So they don't want to spread that or share that or let that be a basis for which they help alleviate suffering. The Shravakas are those who hear the voice of the Buddha, hear the teachings. So at that time, of course, it would have been oral teachings. Now it would be Shravakas, could be practitioners who just read books or maybe listen to talks or watch talks or podcasts and so on. And they come to realization in that way, or they practice and they train, or they practice in that way. But also in that framing, they too have no desire to do more than that. They want to address the sorrows of their life, the impediments of their life. They want to free themselves of that. And that's really the extent of their aspiration. And so within the larger context of Buddhism, and particularly Mahayana Buddhism, these are seen as lesser vehicles because they are missing that all-important aspect of wanting to alleviate suffering for all beings, that to free oneself is not only not enough, but is also seen as ultimately self-centered. Because how do we liberate ourselves and realize self and other as one and not dedicate ourselves to realizing the rest of ourself, the rest of our bodies? And we can think of that also in terms of all the various ways that Buddhism, as is true with most religions, evolved through all different kinds of streams and schools and sects and Buddhism lineages, and I spoke a little bit about this on Sunday, which historically did, from time to time, sometimes quite a bit, set up a kind of sectarianism. Well, which stream is the better one? Which school is the truer one? We don't have to do that in our time. We see all of the harm that has caused throughout history in all religions. And so in that way, this teaching takes on a sort of extended meaning. There's only the Dharma of the one vehicle. The one vehicle being, in this context, the Mahayana vehicle, the vehicle that is about the liberation of self and other. And we can extend that to mean that there is only one Dharma. In the Buddha's time, of course, there was only one Dharma. But now there seem to be many Dharmas, right? Many schools, many traditions. But there's only one Dharma. And so in the Lotus Sutra, from which Dogen is quoting, it says, the thus come ones have only a single Buddha vehicle, which they employ in order to teach the Dharma to living beings. They don't have any other vehicle, a second or a third. The Dharma taught by all the Buddhas of the 10 directions is the same as this. Not only is there one vehicle that the Buddha taught, but all of the Buddhas in all of the different universes that exist within the Buddhist cosmos are only teaching this one vehicle. And then, as he says, as I quoted earlier, when the age is troubled and the times are chaotic, then the entanglements of living beings are grave. They are greedy and jealous, and we put down, or they put down roots that are not good. And so we study the mind. The Buddha was enlightened to the source of that which is not good, the source of greed and jealousy and anger and pride and our confusion, all traced back to the mind. And so we study the mind, mind training. And in studying the mind, we study its movements, we study its stillness, we study its habit patterns, its reactivity. We study all of the organisms, the beings that arise out of what we call mind. We see how it proliferates. We see how it's, this mind seems to have a mind of its own at times. We see how deeply influenced it is, certainly in the early years of training and practice, both from what arises internally as well as what's going on externally. We study our karma, the actions that arise out of our intentions, which are articulated desires, which arise out of some basis, a mental state, an emotional state, an habitual state, and then the consequences of those, and the impact of those consequences on ourselves and on others. And in that, we learn how to, in a sense, practice that from all sides. When it's happening, after it's happening, happened, before it happens, when we're aware of it happening, when we're not aware of it happening, when we care that it's happening, when we don't care that it's happening. In other words, we try and learn that we can practice it from every side, in every angle, from within ourselves. And most importantly, we study how all of those moments when things are arising and the mind is arising and responding at the same time. And then we respond to that, and then we respond to that, or react to that, we react to that. We begin to see and recognize more and more clearly what we call the self. This sense of someone who seems to be present so much of the time. And our relationship, our relationship, the role of that sense of self within our mind, within our being. And how it's only because of the self that there can be attachments. Attachments always sort of adhere to the self. They arise from the self and adhere to the self. And we study, as the Buddha said over and over again, we study all of the sort of all of the ways in which we dwell within the realm of aversion. All the many forms of no, not this, not happening. You go away, I'll go away. Rejection, denial, avoidance, negation. And then we also see all the many forms of the grasping, clinging, wanting, wanting more, wanting this, wanting that. We begin to see how the things that arise, the more we cling to them, the more we sort of get drawn into their vortex. That the thing originally that arises can become more and more secondary. In the beginning, it's mingled with mind and consciousness and memories and associations and entanglements, and we don't see the mingling, so we just impute those qualities into the thing itself. But the more and more we get caught up in the karmic mind, the habit mind, then in a sense, while our eyes may be focusing on something, we may still be listening to someone or something, that more and more the mind is being drawn into itself and is now proliferating within itself. It's like we just needed a little jump start, a suggestion of something to trigger all of those associations. And now it's more and more just building it up within itself, by itself. And so the object becomes more and more of an object. And that's when it becomes more and more dangerous. Because the heart recedes, there's a little recognition. And within that little caring about what it is we're in relationship to, it becomes more and more self-directed. But we also see how that shifts, how that can always shift, how there's nothing fixed about that. There's nothing decided in advance. And although it can seem like a very deep groove, that, you know, much of the time, particularly in early years, once things get going, they're within the mind of the practitioner, there actually isn't a lot of choice. I'm sure we all experience that, where it's like, looking back, it was like, I don't remember having recognized any choices there. Right? There was just reaction, action. And that's a real thing, real in the sense that it can be very tangible, in the sense that we don't, in that very strong sort of habit mind, have a lot of control, right? We're caught. And that's what begins to change, is we realize, while that was never true in any true sense, within our perception, it was true. And what begins to change is that there's a sense of slowing down, but time is not slowing down. We're just more in the time in which things are occurring. It seems as though there's more space in which to have more of a view, to see not just what's in front of us, but what's beyond this. If I take this step, what happens next? We can be pretty sure about that. We can see what else is going on. We can see more into the person who's in front of us, not just the surface. We can see more into situations and not just on the surface. And it's as though there's more space, but there's not more space. We're just now in the space, the spaciousness that has always been there. And in that way, we're learning, actualizing how to take responsibility. Which in a way, we might say, is one of the most important parts of a spiritual practice. Certainly in Buddhist practice, that we are taking responsibility for our mind. And that's why it's so important to recognize that what we call mind, our conscious mind, is a joint effort, so that as we take responsibility, we realize what we need to take responsibility for is what is appearing in this moment. Not for everything that was put in to that mind, for all of the experiences and teachings and messages and influences that we've had that have come from every direction, that have so profoundly influenced and taught and sort of conditioned our mind, that much of that was not of our asking or choosing, or even our conscious awareness, but now it is the stuff of what we call our mind, and it is very much the stuff of what arises and finds its way into our voice and into our thoughts and into our actions, and the karma that we're creating. And so that's where we need to take responsibility. And that's not a small thing. And we see how challenging it is to practice when we want to take responsibility. We really do. We're eager. We're mostly eager, but we want to. We want to, and sometimes we need some encouragement, but and still how difficult it can be. So when we or someone else does not really want to take responsibility, is not able to, doesn't think that way, how difficult that is. That's why in the Lotus Sutra it says, because of this, the Buddhas, utilizing the power of expedient means, apply distinctions to the one Buddha vehicle and teach it as though it were three or 3,000. In other words, there's just one Dharma. But because we as beings are so particular within our own place and have our own particular view, which is very particular to us, and that we are very much absorbed within, wedded within, that there are different sort of capacities, different windows that are open for each of us, different doorways, different ways that we can hear or receive something, take something in. And so there have to be different ways of teaching, different ways of conveying this one Dharma vehicle in innumerable ways that meet the needs of the practitioner or the person. Needs being not only what will help them, but what we can actually receive. That's why the teaching of Upaya is so profoundly important. You know, we might think that Dharma, the Dharma of the Ten Directions, being so, by its very nature, liberated, being so powerful, being such a profound reality, has some sort of absolute power, right? To enlighten us, or to shift our mind, or to be heard. And it doesn't. It doesn't have intention. It doesn't have skillfulness. It doesn't have things. And so how it's taught has to be conveyed through voices and language and forms and gestures and skillfulness. How do we help someone when they're asking for help? That would seem easy, but it's not always. How do we help ourselves when we really want help and yet sometimes it's hard to actually apply what is skillful? Sometimes because what is skillful, but we don't recognize it in the moment. We want to know now. Is this skillful? Show me. And that's not the way that's going to work in that particular moment. More so, how do we live our vows and try and help others when they're not asking? Not open, not interested. And as many of the teachings say, are actively sort of throwing it back in our face. Whatever the help is, I'm not talking about just expounding the Dharma, but just offering help. The Ten Directions spoken of here have taken up the Buddha land and made it what it is. Thus, without taking it up, there can be no Buddha land. because it is the Buddha land, the Buddha is its host. What are these 10 directions that Dogen is speaking about? He says the 10 directions enter one direction. They enter one Buddha. This being so, the 10 directions appear in the 10 directions. Because the 10 directions are one direction, this direction, self-direction, present direction, and the 10 directions are the eyeball of direction, are the eyeball direction, the fist direction, the bare pillar direction, and the lantern direction. The 10 direction Buddhas in the 10 direction land are neither large nor small, neither pure nor stained. And in that, he's referring to different koans in which the fist, the eyeball, the pillar, the lantern are presented in the same way that Dogen says the fist in the 10 directions, just this, or the fist, just one, is the 10 directions. He's referring to other koans in which, in essence, the eyeball, the bare pillar, the lantern have also been held up as the 10 directions. That which has no boundary, that which moves in all directions, that which is has no ground, cannot be contained. And he's saying the 10 directions appear in the 10 directions. They enter one Buddha, one practitioner, one breath, one awareness, one letting go. Vast, untethered, boundless, within space, within time. And so he says these 10 directions that I'm speaking of have taken up the Buddha land and made it what it is. This vast, boundless reality. Sometimes we call it emptiness. One aspect of it is what we call Buddha nature. Sometimes we speak of it as emptiness as form, and form as emptiness. Without those 10 directions, Dogen is saying, there can be no Buddha land. But because there is a Buddha land, the host of that Buddha land is Buddha. In the Vimalakirti Sutra, Vimalakirti speaks of this. The Buddha, actually, is speaking here. And he says, a Buddha field, a Buddha land, a bodhisattva is a field of living beings. And a bodhisattva embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that they help develop living beings. So Dogen is saying the 10 directions, this vast boundlessness, is present in every phenomena, everything, an eyeball, a hand, a lantern, a bridge, a sensation, a breath, a koan. And that basic space is what gives rise to the Buddha land. And that Buddha land, that Buddha field, is a place where we each find ourselves. And we find ourselves in that Buddha field so that we can develop living beings. And while we raise bodhicitta to liberate, to develop all beings, putting others before ourselves. In order to do that, we have to have developed our skills. To liberate others, we have to be liberating ourselves. That's how it works. And so we sit here in Sishin, in this Buddha field in which our Buddha fields are mingling. And we are developing whatever living beings we find in that Buddha field. Nice to have you all here. Thank you for allowing me in to your Buddha field. So we can develop each other. And in doing that, we need to be that Buddha, the host, and take responsibility for this Buddha land and all the those who wander into it. And so he goes on to say, the Buddha in the Vimalakirti Sutra, that this Buddha field has certain qualities. And so he says it is a Buddha field of high resolve. That what we need to, one of the skills we need to develop, the qualities we need to cultivate is to have high resolve, right? So even within our moments of confusion or doubt or uncertainty or insecurity, that we have resolve, which is really the role of commitment. You know, that's why, you know, whether somebody is coming for a week or a month or a session or a lifetime, one of the things that we always discuss is commitment. That is resolve. To be resolved for this session, for this period of Zazen, for this month or year, for this lifetime that I am devoting to this Buddha field. There we have high resolve. And think about how powerful that is. Think about how it goes when you don't have it, when our resolve is wavering. We're uncertain, we're unsure, we're doubting, and we can't find that resolve. And the reason we can't find it, it makes sense, is because it's still developing. In fact, that's how it develops. But in that moment when we can't find it, it's very precarious. Suddenly, many things are possible, not all of them good. When we take vows, the bodhisattva precept vows, when the monastics take the vows of the monastic life, that's what we're doing. We're establishing high resolve for these particular teachings, for these practices. Right? So for the monastics, that vow of that resolve to live a life of stability, that resolve to live a life of selflessness. That means when that's just a daily, it's like breathing. It's like that's the ground we're walking on. That's the atmosphere we're breathing. That's what we're making our life about. And then when that stability or that selflessness becomes wobbly, we practice it on from that ground of resolve, right? If we haven't made that resolve yet, then that ground sometimes is harder to find, right? Rather than it reaching in all directions, it might be a little like a little island, you know, that you have to find. But it says it's a field of generosity. It's a field of giving, which is, when we think of, you know, rather being in a field of stinginess or miserliness, you know, not enough, never enough. You know, it's sort of, you know, what our sort of economic system is built on is that whatever you have, it's not enough. So much immediate, whatever you are, whatever you look like, whatever you've done, it's not enough. Never enough. It's like a constant state of impoverishment. And so here it's rather a field of generosity, of giving, trusting. No need to cling, no need to pull things back. That practicing generosity actually brings more, brings greater abundance. And that's what allows us, that generosity to extend to others, right? Because everybody knows the desire to be generous with oneself, to give as much as we can to ourselves. But true generosity then makes it not only possible, but logical, natural, necessary, desired to give to others. He said it's a field of morality, taking responsibility for our thoughts, our words, our actions. They are so powerful. We're sending them out all the time, every moment, every moment, every moment. And so we practice the precepts, which help us to pay attention to what are those particular streams of thought and speech and action that, on one hand, cause the most trouble, but on the other hand, are the most liberating, are the most powerful, are the most virtuous, are the most freeing. He said it's a field of patience to have great urgency and patience. What a beautiful couple. That within that urgency, that sense of the patience is not waiting, and that there is a house on fire, that from within that urgency, we find patience. I think of Martin Luther King Jr. saying, talking about the mountaintop and saying, I may not get there. Indeed. The desire to alleviate the suffering of all beings, to free not only all people of oppression, but the oppression makers. To free all delusions. For all of us to know we are living within a Buddha field. And that the Bodhisattva has that great vow, that great resolve. But is patient, meaning they may not see it all the way. When we die, there may be a few more suffering sentient beings remaining. It's a field of effort, of being joyfully engaged, interested in life. You know, it's, you know, life is dukkha. In a troubled and chaotic world, you know, facing, you know, the stuff of our suffering and it hurts. Facing the suffering of others and it hurts a millionfold. And yet to realize, to remember that we're in this, we're doing this because of joy, because of loving life and wanting everyone to have a life that they love. So it's not, this practice is not a burden. It's not our homework. It's not something we ought to be doing. The taking responsibility is, thank you very much for this opportunity in this life, in this Buddha field, to be responsible. That as we face all that is challenging and difficult beyond imagination, we also see at the same time the wonder, the beauty, the goodness, the kindness, the generosity, the patience. He says it's a field of meditation. Each moment, each day, our whole life becomes. To really take that in, you know, to really free our sense of zazen and meditation from something that is restricted to the cushion, as something that is restricted by nothing. It's a field of wisdom, more and more understanding, studying, realizing, manifesting things as they are. He said it's a field of the four measurables. I was watching the speech by Raphael Warnock, the senator from the new senator from Georgia, who was giving his first speech on the Senate floor, and he talked about active peace. That to be peaceful and active, the four measurables, to be actively, not just wishing for loving kindness and compassion, gladness and impartiality, but actively working to bring those forth. It's a field of skillful means, right? There is no rule. There is no book. Everything is alive. It's a field of total dedication. Being dedicated. I dedicate myself to. What is it like? What is it to live a life that is dedicated? Not just a life that is happening because you're breathing, because we wake up and here's the day, so I'll go about and take care of things, but we actually wake up in a dedication to what? And to the power, I was going to say the beauty of the Dharma, but really it's the beauty of our mind is that all of these qualities in this Buddha field, which bring forth the Buddha field itself, in which you are the host, are always present, right? We're not making anything up new. We're not creating anything. We're just kind of letting things out of the box, letting them out of their cage, setting them free, taking off their leashes of all of these qualities, and that in all of the moments when something is lacking, something that we need, right, to know deep in you that it must be there. It has to be there. You're just a human being, right? How could what you need in this moment, faith, trust, resolve, patience, generosity, awareness, how could it be lacking, right? And just to know that that is not really possible. So now, with that resolve, with that dedication, you dig in, you find it. You know, practice this path. I spoke on Sunday a little bit about the sense of burden. You know, and it's not a burden at all. It's a gift to actually be awake. The burden is not to be awake. To take responsibility sometimes feels like a weight, but it's actually, I mean, in a way, it's not even a gift. It's just the way things are. There is no abdication of responsibility. There's only the self-deceit of that. But to actually consciously know that we can use this life in this way, to give it, to wake it up. And that to do that for real is going to shake the roots of your tree. I didn't make that up. And so there does, that's why we need resolve and dedication and patience and generosity. And so Dogen says, a meal waits for you to eat it. A robe waits for you to wear it. What a pity if you don't take it while it waits for you. Here it is. This water here, you're so thirsty, it's here for you to drink. This table that's been set, the sumptuous meal, it's been here, laid for you. What a pity not to sit down. This seat, this hall, this time. Turn it around, this meal, this robe, this place, this week, this session, how fortunate that you are here to take it. You know, in a way, what I wish for everybody that walks through the door is they just stick around long enough. They just stick around long enough to see, to begin to see.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.